Welcome to this AHR update with Investment Managers LGT. Joining me today from LGT is Sanjay Risingani, Chief Investment Officer, and Rohit Ahluwalia, Head of International Investments. Thank you both for joining us today. Sanjay, I'd like to start by getting your views on the current state of the global economy and what it is investors should be looking out for as we move into the final quarter of the year.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sanjay Risingani, CIO at LGT Wealth Management. Oh, you've already done the introduction, haven't you, Ian? I'll go straight in. Well, the last few months has been quite interesting from a market dynamics perspective. I think we've had a summer where data has surprised on the upside. So if you look at the individual aspects of data, the labor market, some of the services data, despite what's been quite an aggressive rate hiking cycle, both here in Europe, including the UK, as well as the US, we've seen GDP growth surprise on the upside. So a lot of this talk about soft landing, well, what's soft landing? We're actually in expansion mode still. So, you know, things have been quite resilient. But on the back of that, there are concerns that central banks will continue with their aggressive stance of raising rates until there is a little bit of pain and pricing pressures do ease. And as a result, like I said, on one side, we've had strong data over the last 3 months, but on the other side, we've had rising bond yields. In fact, if someone would have told me at the start of this year that your 10-year treasury will approach 5%, I think would have laughed at them. But here I am sitting in front of you and our listeners, Ian, and guess what? You know, we hit about 4.8% towards the sort of back end of last week. So clearly a lot of nervousness that the central banks may continue their aggressive stance, which may potentially lead to a policy error. In terms of looking the other end of the world, in Asia, the story's been quite a bit different. China continues to grab the headlines in that part of the world, whereby they have tried to inject stimulus, tried to get foreign investors to come in, but it hasn't worked so far. And the reason it hasn't worked so far is one, the constant barrage of bad communication between the US and China, which is impacting other developed markets from going in, but also from a market perspective that wants to see a little bit more from the Chinese authorities. Whilst they've gone out there, they've vowed that they're going to tackle a youth unemployment. They've vowed that they're going to go out there and aid the elderly. They reduced their lending rates. They've also gone out there and provided policy measures to prop up the ailing property market. But none of that's been done on a bazooka scale. It's all quite incremental, and I think the market's looking for something a little bit more meaningful. And we might yet get that. So we haven't lost hope. As you know, Asia is one of the jurisdictions that we're keen on, but sentiment towards the region will only change once we see Chinese markets pick up. And the reason why I say we might yet get that is because over the last few days we've seen reports that the Chinese authorities are quite happy for the budget to expand from where it is today, which means that we may see further stimulus and slightly more aggressive stimulus. And let's not forget, valuations in the region continue to be quite attractive. Coming back to the developed world, I think the biggest surprise was a few weeks ago when the Bank of England decided not to raise rates. That did come as a shock to the market, and then we saw gilts up until that point had underperformed. They sort of outperformed the other sovereign bond market, but let's not get carried away. They didn't actually rally. It's just that it didn't fall as much in following weeks, and that's quite interesting. So obviously the Bank of England has taken quite a different view to the US and the European central banks. And when I say different, I'm talking about the fact that they're not willing the consumer to suffer any more pain. They can clearly see with the remortgage market being very tough for consumers and households, with prices being elevated, they'd rather let the currency take the pain. And that's why if you look at the last month and a half since the Bank of England refrained from raising rates, we've actually seen the pound weaken against the dollar. So they're quite happy for that. Of course, there's a risk with that. You know, it weakens too much, then we pretty much import everything. So it might feed through to the inflationary numbers. So there is a big risk, but they were the first central bank to sort of indirectly acknowledge that they don't want the consumer to suffer any more pain. One final aspect I want to touch upon, and that's, of course, the oil market. The oil market is one that we have to keep a very close eye on. I think we spoke about oil at the last meeting we had, Ian, where you asked what's the biggest risk out there. And we said, well, if the oil price goes beyond $120, that's a big risk because it's a nasty tax. It's a tax on households. It's a tax on the corporate market, corporate world. So that's something that we could do well without at a time when conditions are already tightening. And of course, we've seen the Saudis cut production over the last few months. So did the Russians. And we were optimistic in August that they might actually go back to normal production. But they not only decided not to revisit their production on a monthly basis, they talked about not looking at it till December. So that took the oil price up some 25-30% in short order. And then, of course, the unfortunate harrowing events over the weekend have probably further put a floor underneath the price of oil. And just touching upon the weekend's events, you know, we have to be careful that it doesn't spread. You know, we don't want a situation where all of a sudden Israelis put a lot of pressure on the U.S. to impose sanctions on Iran, or there's an attack on their nuclear facility, which will all of a sudden take the oil price way higher than what it is today. So uncertainty within the region can create ripples, can create further volatility. The initial reaction of the market, at least on Monday, was to take the oil price higher, but everything else seemed to be relatively well behaved. We saw U.S. equities rally primarily on the back that, you know, as things tighten, as conditions tighten, there is a feeling that the central bank, the Fed in the U.S., might also be done with their rate hikes. Some of the Fed members of the last few days have been quite vocal in their sort of dovish stance. And that's, again, something the market was not expecting. And that's why we've seen a bit of strength. So a lot going on, and what that means going forward. I think, you know, corporate results will be even more important than before. We just have to see which businesses are in a position to cope with this, you know, higher rate environment, you know, higher borrowing cost environment. And more importantly, which businesses are being impacted by the slowdown of the consumer spend. And talking of slowdown, you know, in the last 48 hours, we've had LVMH, you know, a bellwether in the luxury goods industry, and they've cited a slowdown in the U.S. consumer, whereby they've stopped buying premium champagne, they're buying cheaper champagne. I didn't know you could get cheaper champagne, by the way, but there we are. So there are signs out there that the higher rate environment is now beginning to impact the way you and I spend.
Thanks, Sanjay. I mean, I think at some point on this conversation, it'd be great to come back to your point there about policy error. So we'll kind of park that there for now. And then Rohit, just moving on to the fund strategies. It's been quite an active 3 months across the different funds. Could you maybe just talk us through, you know, what's been going on the trading side, and I guess some of the main sort of thoughts behind that as well?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's always been, you know, just as a reminder for the listeners here, in terms of we'll cover the equity part of the process first. And, you know, as a reminder, there's four underlying pillars that drive our equity strategy. You know, we look for quality companies, you know, looking for companies that generate shareholder value. So, from an accounting terms, return on invested capital in excess of their weighted average cost of capital. We like companies that have free cash flow at a relatively capex light, so it's your quality part of the equation. We like to consider valuations, you know, that is an input into the process. We also consider something called shareholder yield, which is the way companies return cash to shareholders in the form of dividends and buybacks and debt reduction. And then finally, we look at price action, so momentum. You know, in our thinking on the desk here, there's little point of having all those first three pillars, shareholder yield, valuation, and fundamentals looking strong, but if you don't have the tailwinds in terms of price action behind it, you're not really going to make money out of that. And I think that comes down to really the oil sector. which I think is one of the kind of the questions you may have touched on as well, or we're going to touch on. You know, that was a big part of our theme, and we can get into that in a bit more detail. But, you know, coming into the year, we're probably running at about 22% in the oil sector as part of our balanced equity exposure, if that makes sense. That came off quite materially to be at about 6% just in the earlier part of the summer. We took that capital and rotated it to some of the technology names that we touched on earlier in the year, just leading into that strength. And what really happened over this part of the summer more recently, you know, bringing our energy weighting back down to 6%, we are energy bulls over the longer run for reasons we can get into. But we started to see the energy sector on an individual name basis, where the individual absolute and relative price action started to improve with some of the names that we like in the energy space. So in the earlier part of August, we started to lean back into the energy sector again by adding some exposure to Shell and Total and keeping our position in ExxonMobil. Long story short, as you see in September, you saw a big spike in the energy sector as a whole, and that actually really benefited the portfolio quite materially. Other areas more recently, you know, we've had some healthcare names in the portfolio, such as Novo Nordisk. They've had the tremendous success on the back of the obesity drug that was released, or the news of that obesity drug that was announced over the last quarter or so, and that's been a big tailwind. But outside of that, mainly it's isolated to the energy space, and chopping and changing some of the names that we like, but really using that exposure to tilt where to either sectors or individual stocks that are working. And at the moment, that's kind of in the healthcare and resources space, and at the very absolute margin, tech. But that looks like it's beginning to moderate. Now, turning your attention to the bond side, I'll be honest, we haven't done anything. We've been quite, you know, any flows that have been coming into the fund, we've been rotating the, putting that exposure into the fund on the short end of the curve, as we've done all year long, you know, keeping relatively high quality, shorter duration bias. So, you know, 2.8 years duration at the moment, and just clipping the coupons as we go along. And that's kind of helped buffer some of the volatility. While it's been exciting on the equity side in terms of the activity, the bond side has been less so. Hope that helps.
Yeah, absolutely. So just on that bond side then, you know, you've had quite a sort of short duration, you know, as an aggregate position there. Is that something that we would expect to continue?
Yeah, you know, think about this, right? You know, just a couple of things I'll say here. When you look at the performance of the bond book this year, right? So, you know, for investors, when you look at the broader bond market, it's been an absolutely volatile year, right? So some ETFs for your listeners, if they want to look at what is called the IEF, which is a 7 to 10 year treasury ETF, that's a good proxy for, you know, roughly a 10 year. And then another one is LQD, which is the US corporate bond ETF. Those are your big behemoths in the US. If you look at the year-to-date performance of those to the end of September, they're down 2.6% for the IEF, and the LQD is down negative 0.62. Okay, so it's been an absolute roller coaster ride for bond investors this year, especially considering the optimistic view coming to the year. But for our investors, you know, we've kept a relatively short duration profile, keeping that sort of barbelled approach. Any money that's coming in, we're buying shorter duration credit. And actually, the bond part of the portfolio, if you look at the balance and you look at the attribution, it's actually up 2.6% for the year. So it's done a pretty good job in terms of buffering that interest rate volatility from the duration side. But then you're collecting your coupons by some of the credit risk that we're taking. So I think that served our listeners and investors very well in this particular part of the portfolio. You know, you've heard me say this before, textbook case. Yeah, I think Sanjay's heard this millions of times. Is a textbook case? Yeah, absolutely. You know, typical recession, all the cards on the table, you know, your fundamentals point to, say, buy duration. Valuations also point towards buying duration. But clearly, there's a lot of technical dynamics that are happening out there. One, in terms of price action itself. We haven't seen that confirmation in price action. right? So rather than going out and trying to be the clever hero and trying to chase the absolute top in yields or the absolute bottom in terms of the price movement of some of the bond markets, i.e. the duration side, we'd rather just wait for things to stabilize before we start dipping our toe in. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where we are now. And from another technical side, one thing, you know, you got to keep in mind, you know, what's happened this year with the bond market. You know, you've seen kind of some of foreign buyers begin to start to step away in terms of buying some of the issuance. You've seen some of the banks, you know, dry up, not completely, but dry up in terms of how much they're buying in terms of their own balance sheets. And then also you've had kind of quantitative tightening in the background where they're just kind of letting the sureties roll off. At the same time, on the other side of the equation, you know, your supply side, you've seen, you know, issuance come through from some of the fiscal policy measures that have been that have been coming through. And they've had to roll this debt over to longer dated issuance. And that's supply coming onto the market with three of the bigger buyers kind of moderating how much they're buying. That really leaves the domestic sector in the U.S. to absorb that excess supply. So, you know, from a technical perspective, this has kind of acted as somewhat of a headwind to some of the treasury market as well. At least you kind of postulate what's going on. So that's kind of the reason why we've avoided that. When we expect to add the duration, look, I think really want to be careful here, right? Let's just look at the simple math. You go out today and buy a 1.1-year U.S. Treasury and get paid 5.3%. We're making a little bit more on that in the fund because we're buying some of the corporates where the credit quality is high. Or alternatively, you know, that carries 1-year duration. Or you can go out and buy a 10-year treasury note, and as of prior to coming into this meeting, that's trading at about 4.67. Let's call it 4.7 for about 7.5, maybe 8 years duration. So a lot more interest rate risk for not a lot of interest rate payoff, right? So that's another way of saying the term premium, i.e. the why would you want to lend someone money for such a long period of time when you're not getting compensated for the risk of doing so, right? And one of the risks I would highlight is coming back to your point on volatility. You know, every day it's 10 to 15 basis point moves in the 10-year treasury bond market. That's not normal. 10, 15 years ago, the markets would have been in an absolute panic and it would have been all over the news. This is typical activity now. So when you factor in how much volatility you're taking on for that return, kind of happy being on the short end. Until we're absolutely comfortable that it's the time to dip our toe in for the duration side. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, I think the point you made there on the demand dynamics and the weakness there, I think that's really interesting and something that, you know, everyone kind of refers to, you know, the interest rate inputs and how that's affecting prices, which is true. But I don't think people are perhaps aware of that demand dynamics and that weakness there and how that can really import on the price side as well.
I'd say the demand is probably a lot less stronger than it would have been in the past, right? And you got supply coming in and supply demand dynamics were going to influence your interest rates as well.
Yeah.
And longer term, I've got probably more concerns over the longer run. You know, a lot of these supply side issues, you know, suppose everyone's right on this soft landing, right? What's going to end up happening is demand moderates and then, you know, some of these supply side issues haven't really gone away, right? So demand basically moderates, rebounds. And then what ends up happening is you just end up rubbing into the supply side constraints again. You got fiscal measure, you know, governments have learned that fiscal policy is a great tool to help kind of get you out of the economic doldrums, so to speak. And I'm pretty sure they'll be inclined to use them again at the speed at which it has that economic impact. You know, that'll be leading to deficits, which need to be funded, and that could be to upward pressure on rates over the longer run, because inflationary uncertainty becomes much more elevated. And throw in some of the more of the capex constraints, the onshoring, resource scarcity. You know, you sort of got this recipe for inflation uncertainty, which may manifest itself in a potential larger term premium when you come out at the end of this. So. It's not really something, you know, screaming out and saying, banging a drum, want to buy it now, just because of the compensation side that we touched on here in terms of what you're getting paid. Equally, there's other issues going on which are just kind of keeping us at bay for now. Why take the risk if you don't need to, is the point I'm making.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I guess kind of loosely on that point, the narrative that kind of seems to be dominating the media at the moment, Sanjay, is the higher for longer. We've seen rate expectations in the US kind of adjust up higher, you know, the consensus view into 2024 in particular. What, you know, we've seen the impacts on equity and fixed income markets over the last few months. What does it mean, you know, when we get those higher interest rate expectations? What does it mean for equity and bond markets?
Well, it means different things for different sectors and different asset classes, Ian. At the end of the day, we use the word higher for longer. It's because we've had it zero for so long. I mean, the reality is what we're going through now is more a normalized climate, right? Arguably, you know, rates are a little bit higher than their long-term averages. We might see them come off, but where the anomaly lies has been the last decade, not what we're going through now. So we have to put things into perspective. But what it means for money management and our industry is that we just have to be a lot more selective. So the decade of arguably passive investment where buying the entire index and all the companies, I think you just have to be a lot more selective in what you do. You've got to be more focused on companies' borrowing requirements, you know, how the higher borrowing costs may or may not impact margins, you know, all the pricing pressures that have come to the fore that were not there for over a decade now need to be considered when someone like Roe is going out there and selecting an equity and looking at a particular sector. So it just makes the whole money management arena a lot more interesting. You know, it probably brings active management back to the fore, you know, which for the last decade, like I said, has been playing second fiddle to passive. And on the bond side, let's face it, it gives all our clients a great opportunity. You know, we talk about, you know, has the last year or so seen the death of a balanced 60-40 portfolio? You know, I'm probably in the camp that says, well, it seems the birth of it. I mean, we didn't need a 60-40 portfolio for a decade. All you needed was the equity market, right? We had bonds because we were mandated to do so, and we had bonds in case there was a calamity, and that would provide us with some sort of protection. But right now, you've got roughly half your portfolio for a balanced mandate in bonds, giving you returns of between 5% and 8%, depending on where you want to be on the credit spectrum. So, you know, very, very interesting climate, you know, natural cash flow. And we realize that we have a benchmark now in terms of cash that we have to beat. But the reality is history will tell you over the last 100 years that when we do go through inflationary periods and more normalized interest rate climate like we are now, equities tend to perform a very good job there. They do quite well, provided you're in the right areas, and I guess that's what you look out for institutions like us to do. So yeah, interesting climate, but we've got to be a lot more selective.
Well, yeah. Can I just add on to Sanjay's point there, if that's okay? Is that all right here?
No, yeah.
Just I mean, one of the cool things that we if there's a report that all the listeners should try to look at or get their hands on every quarter, is something called the J.P. Morgan Fundamentals to Credit Markets. It focuses on the IG sector. And what it does is every quarter it evaluates the universe of companies and looks at the leverage and kind of coverage ratios. And we kind of touched on this before, but in previous calls. But what you've actually started to see now is revenue and margins begin to deteriorate. And actually some of the coverage metrics and interest expense start to pick up quite materially. And why is that relevant, right? So that's the key thing. And what does it mean for markets? I think from the bondholder standpoint, this is fantastic, right? Because companies are now, corporate CFOs who have debt out there are now actually reducing their buybacks, reducing their dividends, and being more conservative in their balance sheet management. Because now we're in a higher interest rate world, you know, the projects that you would have taken on in a zero interest rate world versus a 5% interest rate world changes the dynamics completely. So, you know, CapEx is starting to also begin to moderate, at least inflect. And as I mentioned, coverage and some of these metrics are beginning to deteriorate. But the real interesting point is that I think it's going to be a late 2024, potentially even 2025. The exact time is debatable. But what a lot of corporates did in COVID is they took a lot of debt out at very rock bottom interest rates, termed a lot of their debt out. And in many cases, some of this debt is going to start to come due for a big part of the sector in late 24, 25. And that's when you're going to potentially see some pinch points down the road. So this runway could be a lot longer than we expect in terms of the financial issues that come out there. But now let's just think about this, what Sanjay said earlier in terms of selectivity. So all of a sudden, you got corporates for the bond side, they're reducing their buybacks, reducing their dividends. You know, revenue and margins are beginning to deteriorate, focusing more on their balance sheet. Who's going to win out of this? Because at the end of the day, earnings might be moderating as well, right? So on the equity side of the equation, you need to make sure the companies that you hold are still paying dividends, but they're backed up by free cash flow that they generate, or they're still generating earnings, which are maybe more immunized or linked to the cycle that we're at. Just supporting Sanjay's point, is that it's going to be much more discriminatory in terms of fundamentals, both on the credit and the bond side, credit and the equity side of the equation, which is sort of an environment we haven't seen for a long time.
But, yeah, and just to that point, then I think, and Sanjay, you mentioned it at the start of the call. The idea is this idea of potential policy error. You know, we on one hand, a lot of the sort of commentary is around soft landing and then how we can manage the economy through this period. But to some of Rohit's points there around what is to come on the corporate side, what do you think is the probability that we do get a policy error, and what does that do to the narrative of this potential soft landing?
I mean, a policy error, historically has been one where the consumer and the corporate world has not been taken into account, and the only figure in front of you is to tackle inflation, and rates obviously go up arguably more than they should. We see a completely falling off a cliff in terms of economic activity, and then there's a rush to lower interest rates. But by then it's too late, because once sentiment shifts, once you've lost confidence, then it takes a long time to build that confidence back. Now, we live in a slightly different world. You can clearly see that what we've been through over the last 18 months, there's nothing really in history to suggest that we've been through this sort of period before. And what I'm alluding to there is that on one side, yes, the Bank of England and the Fed and the ECB, the rhetoric's been quite aggressive over the last 18 months. We're going to tackle inflation. We're going to bring it down. It doesn't matter if the consumer gets hurt. And on the other side, you've got governments pandering to the consumer saying, oh, don't you worry. Let the central banks keep raising rates. We'll keep bailing you out, right? So it's a very different climate. And one of the primary reasons why we haven't had a recession is because fiscal policy has been so accommodative, right? The fact that when energy bills go up, we have an energy cap there. You know, the fact that, you know, all of a sudden the housing market feels like it's about to crack. The government says nobody can repossess your property for the next 12 months, even if you can't keep up payments. It's a very, very different climate today compared to yesteryear's. The consumer does come at the fore of everything in terms of thinking. So policy error, the risk is a lot lower today than it has been previous hiking cycles because of the government's intervention in terms of their policies and the fiscal stimulus that we are seeing. But nevertheless, it is possible, you know. There were concerns a little bit more around UK being one of the first to go down that route, because if you are just turning a blind eye to overseas events and focusing primarily on your domestic inflationary number, which is what at times we felt the Bank of England were doing, then the risk of policy error obviously went up, that they keep raising rates, because the oil price goes up, energy prices go up, commodity prices go up overseas, and we import everything, and not paying any attention or taking heed of what the consumer is feeling out there. Fortunately, like I said, September was a surprise to a lot of us that they decided not to raise rates and say, you know, we are conscious of the pain that this is causing. Conditions have tightened, inflation prices have eased. So as a result, we're not going to do it, and the currency has taken the pain for that. So yeah, if you break it down, policy error risk in the UK tends to be higher because we're subject to overseas forces, a lot lower in the US because they're in control of their destiny. They have their own energy, they have their own semiconductor industry, and they have their own, you know, strong currency, which is the global currency of invoicing. So a lot less risk there. But looking at how governments behave these days on the back of monetary policy, it seems to me they are the ones that reduce the risk of policy error rather than the central banks themselves.
Okay, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Rohit, any additional thoughts on that point?
No, I agree with everything kind of Sanjay outlined on that.
Yeah.
Nothing further to add.
Okay, well, thank you both. That was very insightful. That concludes the end of this session. Thank you both for joining us. I look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thank you very much for all the support from both of us.